grow, which is why most of what he has to say also applies to travel here in the States. Rick Steves offers an entire chapter on how to travel as a political act, kind of pre-travel preparation. Essentially, connect with people, be open to new experiences, overcome fear, see the world's rich-poor gap for yourself, and take history seriously. Don't settle for life in a dumbed-down society, for a dumbed-down life. Then Steves tours us through surprising destinations, from the European Union, a comfortable starting point for Americans, to Turkey and Morocco, the Holy Land, Iran, yes, Iran, and struggling El Salvador. Traveling thoughtfully, he says, we are inspired by the accomplishments of other people, communities, nations, and can look back at America from a distant vantage point to see ourselves as others see us, an enlightening, if not always flattering, view. But don't get him wrong. He's a proud American, successful capitalist, and thoughtful Christian. His faith, Rick Steves is a Lutheran, fuels his activism for social justice. All proceeds from the book, in fact, go to Bread for the World, a faith-based organization dedicated to ending world hunger. So, travel is indeed a political act. Choosing not to travel, turning away from understanding the vast, varied world we share with other people and cultures, is also a political act, when we really can't afford any more, rich as we are. Until next time, this is Kim Ware for Up the Road.
This is KZFR FM 90.1 Chico, California, community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Today on Ecotopia, we'll continue our discussion of urban and suburban sprawl with particular reference to the Valley's Edge development proposed for Chico.
Made paradise and put up a parking lot. A pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always go to show? You never know what you got till it's gone. They made paradise and put up a parking lot. Took all the trees, they put them in a tree museum. They charge the people a dollar and a half just to see them. Don't it always go to show? You never know what you got till it's gone. They paid paradise, they put up a parking lot. Farmer, farmer, put away the DDT. Give me spots on my apples, but leave me the birds and the bees, please. Don't it always go to show? You never know what you got till it's gone. It'd be paradise to put up a parking lot. Late last night, I heard my screen door slam. A big yellow bulldozer took away the house and land. Don't it always go to show? You never know what you got till it's gone. You pay paradise to put up a parking lot. You pay paradise to put up a parking lot. You pay paradise to put up a parking lot. Hey, paradise, the foot of a parking lot.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. Today, we're going to continue our discussion of urban and suburban sprawl with particular reference to Valley's Edge, where a community referendum is underway to block this mammoth project. I'm Susan Chudy, and by way of full disclosure, I'm active in Smart Growth Advocates, Save Our Hometown, and the referendum campaign.
And I'm Stephen Schutte, and by way of disclosure, I too have been involved in a minor way, to be sure, with the campaign to block Valley's Edge.
We're going to approach Valley's Edge obliquely. First, we'll read several articles about the consequences of urban sprawl elsewhere. Then we'll zero in on the Valley's Edge concerns and referendum.
Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Lily's Brazilian Bistro, offering traditional Brazilian cuisine made from fresh, locally sourced organic ingredients in the heart of downtown Chico. Lily's Brazilian Bistro serves traditional Brazilian dishes as diverse, exciting, and colorful as Brazil itself. It's located at 142 Broadway, open Monday through Saturday from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. with dine-in and outdoor seating. More information, including to-go orders and reservations, are available at 530-399-0675 and on Facebook and Instagram. And we're supported by the North State Symphony, performing an upbeat, lighthearted concert entitled Haydn's Drum Roll. February 11th in Chico and February 12th. Did you know that Haydn wrote 115 symphonies?
I didn't.
I don't think we're going to hear all of those at this thing. February 11th in Chico, February 12th in Reading, showcasing the young talent in our North State. This concert features this season's young artist audition winners as well as area youth orchestras. Selections from Schubert, Telemann, Offenbach, and more will be featured. More information and tickets at northstatesymphony.org. And we want to remind you that the opinions voiced on Ecotopia do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers. We'll take a short break and be back to talk about urban sprawl.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same. And the people in the houses all went to the university where they were put in boxes and they came out all the same. And there's doctors and lawyers and business executives, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same. And they all play on the golf course and drink their martinis dry, and they all have pretty children, and the children go to school, and the children go to summer camp, and then to the university where they are put in boxes, and they come out all the same. And the boys go into business and marry and raise a family in boxes made of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and we're exploring the consequences of growth in urban sprawl. We begin with an article by Autumn Spain in Treehugger, Urban Sprawl, Definition, Causes, and Solutions. She writes, urban sprawl refers to a pattern of low density, often poorly planned development stretching away from an urban center. This trend of outward growth became prevalent in the United States after World War II, when people started leaving densely populated cities for new peripheral suburbs. The rise of the suburbs led to fragmented communities connected by roads and dependent on cars. This trend, also known as suburban sprawl, generally comes with adverse environmental and social impacts, including traffic congestion, air pollution, loss of forests and agricultural lands, and communities that are more segregated by race and class.
So what are the characteristics of urban sprawl? Autumn Spain continues. In the 1930s and 40s, migration from the cities to expanding peripheral developments, called suburbs, came about in part due to federal legislation and policies in housing, transportation, and banking. First aimed at alleviating economic impacts of the Great Depression, and later to accommodate GIs returning from World War II, whose growing families needed affordable homes. Mass production also helped make housing affordable for millions. During the post-war economic boom, American suburbs grew exponentially around cities like Los Angeles, Chicago, Houston, Phoenix, and others. Massive federal highway projects also facilitated this outward expansion. Together, these policies transformed cities and created suburban communities with distinct features.
One characteristic of this expansion was low density and single-family homes. Low-density single-family homes. In the post-World War II era, developers marketed cookie-cutter single-family homes with a garage, driveway, and grassy yards as the attainment of the American dream. The new suburbs were an escape from congested city centers to quiet streets and spacious homes outfitted with all the modern amenities. But huge tracts of low-density single-family homes and scattered haphazard commercial districts also became hallmarks of sprawl. The houses kept getting bigger. Today, an average American home is nearly double the size of those in mid-century suburban neighborhoods.
Another characteristic of sprawl is expanded vacant land use outside the city core. Historically, developers sought to open space further out in the countryside rather than vacant land next to already developed areas. Known as leapfrogging, this gobbled up larger amounts of land and led to disconnected, car-dependent neighborhoods interspersed with fragmented open space. It also led to ribbon developments, alternating residential areas and business zones extending out from city centers along roads and highways. Strip malls are a classic feature of ribbon development, with large parking lots and associated congestion and traffic hazards. Both development approaches were strongly influenced by zoning policies, which designate developments as solely residential or business rather than mixed use.
As suburban neighborhoods multiplied, public transportation infrastructure failed to keep up. Instead, transportation in the suburbs centered around road construction to accommodate automobile traffic, rather than connecting neighborhoods with bus and rail systems or providing alternatives, options like cycling lanes and pedestrian paths. Thanks to zoning and transportation priorities that emphasize roads and single-use developments, residents increasingly relied on cars to get to work and obtain basic goods and services.
Autumn Spain, writing in Tree Hugger, also notes that post-war spread was often segregated. Not everyone had an equal shot at the American suburban dream. Exclusionary zoning and housing and banking discrimination led to suburban communities that were whiter and wealthier, while people of color were often stuck in urban centers. As tax revenue flowed to outlying suburbs, disinvestment in urban neighborhoods led to neglect and blight. Highway construction, which significantly reshaped cities and supported suburban growth, also contributed to deterioration of many urban communities and increased segregation, often intentionally. jobs and other economic opportunities left urban centers, contributing to poverty and, by extension, chronic health conditions. Discriminatory housing policies and racism relegated many Black Americans and other people of color to only narrow slices of cities and suburbs, harming their economic opportunities and their health.
What were the impacts of this? From pollution to safety hazards, the consequences of urban sprawl development only grew with time. Increased use and dependence on cars causes more air pollution and fossil fuel emissions. In addition, inefficient energy consumption in ever larger single-family homes means more demand on electricity and gas systems and more burning of fossil fuels. More impervious surfaces, paved roads, parking lots, sidewalks that don't absorb water also lead to water pollution as toxic chemicals, oil, and bacteria accumulate in storm runoff and eventually flow into natural water bodies. Studies suggest that suburban development is associated with high levels of harmful contaminants.
There's loss of open space with urban sprawl. As land is paved over with housing, roads, and shopping centers, critical wildlife habitat is destroyed. This disruption and fragmentation of habitat through land use change can lead to a decrease in biodiversity and more negative, even dangerous encounters between humans and wildlife. In addition, loss of open space contributes to declining air and water quality by degrading or eliminating ecosystem services like flooding and pollution mitigation. As extreme weather events intensify with climate change, these natural services will become increasingly important for community resilience in the face of flooding, wildfires, sea level rise, and heat.
There are other health and safety impacts. In car-dependent communities, the rates of accidents and traffic-related mortalities increase. Traffic safety measures often don't keep pace with rapid development. Thus, sprawl is associated with less walking and cycling as people avoid them due to safety concerns, contributing to more sedentary lifestyles. Combined with the increased risks posed by air pollution, this can exacerbate health conditions like respiratory illness, cardiovascular disease, obesity, and diabetes.
Okay, the author recognizes the problems created by urban sprawl. Are there solutions? Yes, she writes. Even in the 1950s, people were aware of adverse impacts of sprawl. Over time, citizens and local governments sought to address those concerns, and eventually a movement emerged in response to unbridled sprawl.
For one solution, there is smart growth. In the 1970s, Portland, Oregon became one of the first cities to apply smart growth strategies. Over time, the city concentrated population growth in the urban center rather than expanding suburbs. Today, it reflects many smart growth principles: diverse housing options, plentiful green space, mixed-use developments, preservation of ecologically important areas, and multiple transportation options, including both public transit and accessible walking and biking infrastructure. Smart growth also encourages and facilitates community involvement in decision making and collaboration among stakeholders to ensure that plans consider everyone's needs, regardless of wealth or influence. It is often used interchangeably with terms sustainable development and new urbanism. Though not identical, these approaches all seek more equitable and environmentally sustainable development.
Many of the fundamental changes revolve around transportation, specifically investing in multimodal transportation systems that offer convenient, affordable alternatives to driving while limiting car traffic. Terms like 15-minute city, Walkable City, and Sustainable City reflect strategies to make cities greener, less polluting, and less carbon intensive, while ensuring that residents' basic needs can be met within a short walk of home.
There is also diversification of housing to avoid gentrification. A recent report from the National Association of Home Builders shows that post-pandemic, a new wave of suburban migration is underway. Can the latest suburban boom avoid unsustainable development patterns of the past? One remedy to sprawl and housing shortages involves diversification of housing stock. For years, there's been a trend toward increasing housing density, but the 2020 pandemic revealed drawbacks to ultra-dense apartment blocks. An alternative concept known as distributed density challenges single-use zoning laws and allows construction of multifamily homes or low-rise residential buildings, which take up less space and consume less energy than single-family homes. It can also mean locating denser housing along public transportation corridors for increased access while preserving public green space. A caveat: sustainability measures both in cities, centers, and suburbs can carry the risk of green gentrification. As property values increase according to housing scarcity and improved neighborhood amenities like parks and transportation access, the availability of affordable housing can end up decreasing. Portland, for example, has worked to accommodate population growth without sprawl by focusing on density. But as housing costs rose, so did displacement of low-income residents.
Here in California, some cities, as well as the state legislature, are looking into decades-old zoning laws that restrict residential lots to one single-family home in order to generate more housing stock, combat skyrocketing housing costs, and address housing discrimination. To be truly sustainable, social justice must be addressed alongside environmental objectives.
That was from Tree Hunger by Autumn Spain.
God's gonna get you for that. God's gonna get you for that. There's no place to run and hide, for he knows where you're at. God's gonna get you for that. God's gonna get you for that. Every wrong thing that you do, God's gonna get you for that.
This doggone world we're living in, it's giving me a fit. It seems like everywhere I turn, I see a hypocrite. Well, if you wanna go to heaven, well, you can't live like that. So let me tell you, brother, God's gonna get you for that.
God's gonna get you for that. Yeah, God's gonna get you for that.
In our church, he's a mighty devoted man. Everybody thinks that he's going to the promised land. But the other night on a country road while I was driving through, I caught the preacher making love to Sister Mary Lou.
God's gonna get you for that.
Yeah,
God's gonna get you for that.
There's no place to run and hide,
for he knows where you're at. God's gonna get you for that.
She likes to testify. She says, I always love the Lord. Someday I'm gonna fly. But the other night while going by the local liquor store, I caught old Sister Bessie flying out the door.
God's gonna get you for that. God's gonna get you for that. There's no place to run and hide, for he knows where you're at. God's gonna get you for that. God's gonna get you for that. Every wrong thing that you do, God's gonna get you for that. God's gonna get you for that. Yeah, God's gonna get you for that.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 Chico, and tonight we're looking at some of the causes and consequences of urban sprawl. People have been decrying urban sprawl for years. This article from the farmer's perspective not only describes the dangers of sprawl, but provides solutions that are still relevant today. From this article that was written over 20 years ago about how we can diminish our dependence on sprawl for housing.
Inefficient suburban development, low-density sprawl is consuming far more of California's unique agricultural land than is necessary to accommodate its growing population. With the number of people living in the state's most important agricultural valleys expected to triple within about a generation, only a more efficient form of development that consumes less land per person, smart growth, can save the Golden State's unique farmland. Land that not only supports the planet's most diversified productive agricultural industry, but also provides wildlife, habitat, and other amenities that contribute to Californians' high quality of life.
Today, smart growth has a hard time competing with sprawl in the marketplace. But this is not simply the result of free, impartial economic system in which consumers naturally choose low-density housing and big-box retailers because they are cheaper and more convenient. Rather, myriad public policies, from property taxation to development fees to planning decisions, skew the economics of land development in favor of sprawl and against smart growth. These policies and the attitudes that perpetuate them must be comprehensively and systematically changed if California is to prevent sprawl from laying waste to what are arguably the world's most important agricultural valleys.
Again, this article is from the Farmland Information Center. They commissioned Stephen Moss, a partner in the San Francisco-based consulting firm of M Cubed, to examine how public policies influence the efficiency of suburban development in the Salinas Valley and the Great Central Valley. Moss conducted a broad inventory of public policies. He identified and attempted to quantify those that appear to have a significant influence on the competition between sprawl and smart growth. In a sample of local jurisdictions, including Fresno, Madera, and Monterey counties, and the cities of Fresno, Madera, and Salinas.
The recommendations from the Farmland Trust were developed to protect farmland, but they seem to us on Ecotopia to be good for smart growth generally. Number one, adopt local general plans that favor more efficient development and enforce them in the zoning and development permitting process.
Two, build efficiency into zoning and subdivision standards by permitting greater flexibility in housing configuration, setbacks, and street widths.
Three, reinforce general plans by appropriately siting public facilities and making infrastructure investment that encourage efficient development patterns.
Four, remove artificial financial obstacles to smart growth by immediately reducing development fees on compact housing and eventually adjusting entire local fee structures to reflect higher costs of sprawl.
Five, study reforms of local government finance that could ameliorate the pressure on them to attract development, any development, as a cash cow.
Six, study mechanisms for greater regional cooperation in land use policymaking to avoid competition that leads to sprawl.
Seven, study reforms of electricity and other utility rate structures that could take advantage of the cost savings of smart growth patterns.
8, put smart growth to a fair market test with pilot projects that guarantee developers a reasonable rate of return if they build more efficient housing and commercial projects. Sound recommendations, we think, from the Farm Trust.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and tonight we are looking at some of the effects of urban sprawl. And in the North State and elsewhere, we've become increasingly aware of how sprawl impacts wildflowers and wildfires and how wildfires impact sprawl. Here's an editorial from the Los Angeles Times, and it's entitled California Leaders Downplay the Dangerous Effects of Sprawl During Wildfires. And, we're not going to be happy about that. The devastating and deadly wildfires that have swept across California were supposed to be a wake-up call that would finally force local governments to rethink new housing development in high fire risk areas. From Redding to Santa Rosa to Ventura, suburban neighborhoods, once thought to be fireproof, were destroyed by fast-moving flames. Even new homes built to the most up-to-date standards were charred. Communities that thought they were safe from wildfire discovered that their notification systems, evacuation routes, and preparations were woefully insufficient for these bigger, faster, and more intense fires.
The LA Times editorial continues. In an era when climate change is expected to fuel more frequent and more devastating wildfires, California will need to stop promoting residential sprawl and build denser developments closer to the city centers if it hopes to save lives and protect property. That's why a fire chief in San Diego County raised eyebrows recently when, during a discussion of whether to allow the development of 1,119 homes on chaparral-covered land east of Chula Vista, he suggested that building new homes on the urban fringe could actually help stop the spread of wildfires. What? Cal Fire San Diego County Chief Unit Tony Meacham predicted that the area would burn again. Still, he told the supervisors that the developer had addressed fire safety concerns. And he said modern homes surrounded by fire-resistant landscaping could stop the spread of fire, an assertion many fire experts said was dangerous. Yet, the Board of Supervisors approved the project.
The fire chief is right that new homes built with fire-resistant materials and surrounded by less flammable landscaping are safer than older homes. But fire-resistant is not the same as fireproof. In the 2017 Thomas Fire in Ventura County, newly built homes that met the strictest codes were destroyed. Just because newly constructed homes are safer doesn't mean it's safe or a good idea to keep putting them in areas known to burn. Yet, elected officials continued to approve massive housing developments in high fire risk areas. Last year, the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors approved the Centennial Development, a 19,000 home mini city to be built at Tejon Ranch in a remote valley that's been deemed at high or very high risk of wildfires. Between 1964 and 2015, state fire officials recorded 31 wildfires larger than the 100 acres within 5 miles of Centennial, including 4 within the project's boundaries.
Just like in San Diego, Los Angeles leaders said that their communities desperately need more housing. They argued that inherently dangerous locations could be made safer with fire-resistant construction and landscaping. Developers have made equally disturbing arguments that their projects are making people safer by converting flammable grass and chaparral into, quote, ignition-resistant landscapes. The LA Times then says, by that logic, California can end wildfire risk altogether by paving over the entire state.
To be sure, California has a debilitating housing shortage that is driving up rents and home prices, fueling an increase in homelessness and handicapping efforts to attract and retain businesses. Yet, it should be clear by now that the old way of building, extending farther from the urban centers into high fire risk areas, is dangerous and counterproductive. It puts more people in harm's way, including both residents and the firefighters tasked with protecting these new developments. The threat is only going to grow as the effects of climate change intensify. Worse, remote developments increase the greenhouse gas emissions responsible for global warming. That's because people who move to far-flung subdivisions generally have to commute longer distances to their jobs, and the developments themselves are often built for driving rather than walking, biking, or transit. The LA Times editorial ends, "That's one more reason why Californians have to make room for homes within their existing cities. The state can't keep sprawling to solve the housing crisis."
This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and tonight we're reading from some articles that describe the effects of urban sprawl elsewhere, but with important implications for the city of Chico. Here's an article from the UK Guardian titled, "Their Arizona Community Was Ideal, Then Their Neighbor Cut Off the Water." It was written by Francesca D'Annunzio. It describes the Rio Verde foothills, an unincorporated community with no municipal government near Scottsdale, the fashionable, wealthy desert city adjoining the state capital of Phoenix. None of the homes is connected to a local water district. There's only one paved road, no streets, lights, storm gutters, or pipes in the ground. Instead, residents have wells or water tanks outside their homes, which they used to fill at a local pipe that was serviced by Scottsdale. But 3 weeks ago, Scottsdale turned off that water pipe, cutting off Rio Verde Foothills resident supply. Scottsdale said it was forced to make the move because of the prolonged mega drought affecting the U.S. Southwest. Now, if residents want piped water, that would be purified water, they have to drive an hour each way to Apache Junction, a city that's allowing people to fill their tanks for a fee or pay a hauler to do it. Locals said that instead of paying 3 cents a gallon for water previously, the rate is now 11 cents, which has households scrambling. Now, digging a well isn't an option for everyone. The houses have been built on harder sediments that make the groundwater access more difficult. Where this is going, people have said Scottsdale has caused a humanitarian crisis for these residents and their families. This by Don Slavin, a lawyer representing the Rio Verde Foothills plaintiffs. Water is life in Arizona, a court order read, but sorting out a water dispute, the judge wrote, is the government's job, not the court. So the court decided not to hear the case in favor of Rio Verde. So the point of all this, Phoenix has, of course, annexed greedily. I've read of annexation that takes place 65 miles outside the city of Phoenix. So they're stretching out. I guess they see it as a source of tax revenue, though most of the evidence that we have is that suburban sprawl doesn't pay for itself after the initial development fees paid by the developers, even when they give you a school or a police station or put the water pipes in the ground. The city has to take it over, and that doesn't work. So the income is lost. In this case, we're talking about two issues. One, noting that there's the water table decline. They ran out of water in Rio Verde. And secondly, there are not endless supplies of water for our urban sprawl cities. Scottsdale's decision to cut the water is a sign of what could await other communities in a region that, along with many, is getting drier and hotter in the climate crisis. This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and we're talking tonight about urban sprawl. As we said at the beginning of the show, Susan Schutte has an interest in blocking the Valley's Edge project here in Chico, has been working hard on it, and I can vouch for that, for a long time, and we're coming to some turning points. And I've also been involved, and I also favor the blocking of Valley's Edge as well. So, Susan, tell us a little bit about where we are with Valley's Edge and the referendum.
We are completing this week the signature gathering for the Valley's Edge project. The signatures are being gathered for a referendum that would bring Valley's Edge to a vote. Rather than having five city council members decide what the consequences should be for all of the rest of the people who live in Chico, and as you might know if you listen to the show, we don't live in Chico, but Chico is our every place. Our doctors are here. Our shopping is here. Our veterinarian is here. Our radio show is here. And so Chico is really important to us.
And Valley's Edge is out in Butte County, of which we are members. Valley's Edge influence is not limited to Chico.
Not at all. So if you are interested in having this come to a vote, this Valley's Edge project, and as I was reading again these articles on Sprawl, Valley's Edge represents all of the negative things that have been brought up in these articles. It's on a piece of land that should be left because of the rich ecosystem that's there. It's one of the last vernal pools. We have endangered meadow foam on that land. It's they're both wetlands and important wetlands. The water eventually here ends up in Butte Creek, and we don't want the water of Butte Creek to be polluted. We already have problems with the struggling salmon, with polluted water coming from the development of 2,777 housing units. The development pollution will end up in the water and eventually end up in Butte Creek. So all of the things that the article talks about, the increase in greenhouse gases, we're trying to bring our greenhouse gas emissions down. Our climate action plan in the city of Chico calls for net zero emissions by 2045. This many houses with this many cars going in and out and in and out and in and out of Chico for services and for jobs and for school in some cases will make that impossible to meet our goals for greenhouse gas emissions. The thing that we always hear is we need more housing, we need more housing, but this is not the kind of housing that we need. One of the things that I really like about these articles, we need affordable housing. We need housing for our workforce, for all the people who come in and do things for us. Now they're, you know, people are kind of far flung. So we want them to be able to live in Chico in housing that they can afford. One of the things I really like about this article is the description of smart growth, mixed use housing, some buildings with retail underneath or clinics or other services that people need, insurance companies on the bottom level, and then apartments or condos or we can even do you know, if we need more housing for wealthy people, a lot of people and a lot of retired people are attracted to condos where they don't have to do the upkeep of the grounds. And so smart growth would allow for that kind of growth, would allow for that kind of... We need a new paradigm. We need a new vision. We need to review what housing should look like and what a city should look like. High density does not mean ugly block buildings.
You wrote a letter to the editor where you talked about some people have a dystopian vision of infill. What do you mean by that?
Well, some people think that density equals, I don't know, what do they think it equals? They think
the tenements of New York City.
Yeah, right. Right. They think that really good city planning, and there's a lot of it. There's something called New Urbanism, and one of these articles alluded to it. It should be beautiful. There should be green spaces. There could be little plazas. There are walking spaces. Chico, actually, at the city government tonight, I think they're at the city council meeting, they're talking about having places within Chico closed off, roads closed off, so that they're walkable and bikeable. And if you've traveled to Europe, you've seen that kind of development where the cities are dense and there are, you know, cute little avenues and little alley type places with cafes and retail on the bottom floor and apartments above. And people are out in the streets. People are walking and being together.
We were impressed visiting Reading a few months ago. Talk about the development that we saw there.
Well, that's the kind of development it is. Retail, downtown retail on the bottom level and housing on the top level. We need a new paradigm because sprawl is harmful for the environment. It's harmful for our CO2 emissions. It's putting us in the WUI, the wildland-urban interface, which is where we're struggling with wildfires. We also need greater efficiency. We are facing water shortages in the future. There's no doubt about it. It's starting to be true in the Southwest, but it will also be true here. And so we've got to be more efficient in our uses of housing. No, we don't need any more McMansions. People can live really well without having huge houses with huge yards and estate surrounding them. And so we need a new paradigm. We need to say we value something different. We value infill. We value beautiful housing. We value fair housing. We want people who are not wealthy to be integrated within the community, not separated out and put on the railroad tracks. So we need a new vision. We need a new paradigm, and it needs to include all of the things that will be healthy and create a community for everyone.
Thanks. So there sounds like there are really two phases. One is stopping Valley's Edge, and then secondly, marshaling the community for this kind of new vision. There's no guarantee necessarily. Well, no guarantees of anything, but even if Valley's Edge is quite appropriately blocked, it's no guarantee that people are going to come downtown.
Well, we need housing. So we've got to build housing. Mm-hmm. We simply have to do it, but we can do it with a different vision. And blocking Valley's Edge means we need to come up with some alternatives. Mm-hmm. And we should do that. So if you want to sign the petition, you can go to 313 Walnut Street, Suite 114. It's right next to Azad's. It's the Butte Environmental Council office right next to Azad's martial arts studio. Or you can go to the bookstore in downtown Chico, which is right next to Upper Crust, and they will have a petition there that you can sign. So it's really important, I think, that we let the people of Chico, those of you who can vote in Chico, decide what you want Chico to be and to avoid the urban sprawl that's damaging in so many ways.
Thank you, Susan. And thank you, listeners. You've been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR. Up next is Bobby Tryon with a show that's been retitled, but you've been listening to it. It's now North State Voices. And tonight her guest will be Justina Sotelo. She's the advanced coordinator at Stonewall Alliance, and they're observing Black History Month with a pop-up. It'll be at 6th and Orient next Saturday, 10 to 2. Thank you for listening to Ecotopia.
You are the new day. You are the new day. I will love you more than me and more than yesterday. If you can but prove to me you are the new day. This night might stay yesterday.
Before